Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Mary Harris Jones, better known as Mother Jones, was born in 1830. She lived a quiet, non-public life until she was approximately 47 years old, and then, for almost the next 50 years, she was a fiery union organizer, strike leader, and fighter for safe and humane working conditions, the 8-hour day, and child labor laws. Around the turn of the century, some people called her the most dangerous woman in America. Her legacy has lived on in the form of a magazine that bears the name Mother Jones, and in the form of a one-woman play about her life, produced, acted, and written by singer and songwriter Ronnie Gilbert. I spoke with Mother Jones by phone, who happened to be at Ronnie Gilbert's house in May of 1997. Mother Jones, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Good. It must be quite strange to be talking by telephone.
Oh, it's ridiculous, these newfangled things. You can't see anyone's face. You don't know what they're thinking. All you can do is hear their voices, and I never needed to have such a thing. In my speeches, you could hear me across the field, 2,000, 3,000 people, you know. We were speakers in our day, I'll tell you.
You know what concerns me and is of interest to me, Mother Jones, is what did you do that caused people to fear you so and say you were the most dangerous woman in America? I look at the picture of you. You don't look dangerous.
Of course I was dangerous. I was dangerous to those who thought they could buy everything with money. I just didn't care about money. My life was devoted to the working person and the working man and the working woman, the woman who took care of the home and raised the children and so on. I didn't need their money. I could live on nothing, and I did.
You spent a lot of time trying to change the social conditions where the working person spent her day or his day. I'd like you to tell us, please, about what those conditions were and why you devoted your life to change them.
Well, if you had been, as I was, in the textile factories of the South, where little children, you know, the states all had laws about child labor, but nobody paid any attention to them, you know? And they never enforced them. So when I went south to see what was going on in those factories, I saw little children could barely reach the machinery. The machinery was made small, you know, for the size of the children. These children would stand on boxes to reach the machinery. That's how tiny they were. Children of 9, 10 years of age, sometimes even younger. And then they would bring their little younger children with the sisters and brothers with them to help out. Now, the children that stood on the boxes got 10 cents a shift. Now, a shift is 12 hours long. The little 5-year-olds that came to so-called help them, of course, they weren't paid at all. This is the kind of condition that they had. Half an hour for lunch. The poor little things, they'd fall asleep over their lunch, and then the foreperson would come around and wake them up, you know, to get them back on the machine. Well, you know, it broke my heart. You would be out there too if you were me and you had been in that situation. And then in the factories, even when they had children, when they enforced the law, the children had to be 12 years old to be working. Imagine 12 years old to be working in a factory when they should be gone to school. And then you'd see them with their mutilated hands, you know, from these big machines are very dangerous, and children can't be. They fall asleep. They forget, and, you know, they're hurt.
Mother Jones, how long did you work in the factories observing these conditions before you became a union organizer and a strike leader to make the changes?
Oh, it was 2 or 3 years.
Was there something that occurred that finally caused you to change working in the factories and get out?
Sorry, I didn't hear you very well, the first part of your...
Was there something that occurred in your life or something that you saw that made you decide that you had to make this change?
Yes, I saw that working people were beginning to understand that the enemy was capitalists and that they were going to be able to come together. It was happening all over the world, you know. And I was thrilled by the groups of people that got together and began to think of a future that would mean something to the future generations. And the songs, I loved the songs they sang. Storm the 40 nights of labor, battle for your cause. That was some group, that Knights of Labor. I belonged to that group. Oh, there were many things that were happening. You know, at the end of the Civil War, people were unemployed, and soldiers were back from the war. They didn't have jobs. It was a terrible time, and there was also a terrible depression. I saw that something had to be done, and I found a group of people who were unionists who were going to do something about it. Those were the days of the martyrs, I tell you. They were saints, those people. So I joined up with... And I made speeches, and I collected money, and so forth, and so on.
What kinds of things did you say that would persuade a family person to not go to the mills and instead go to the picket line and risk their income and their life and perhaps their family?
I would say to them, look at you people. You're standing there with your bellies empty and your shoes thin, and you don't do anything about it. When are you going to take what's properly yours? I would say to the men, look at you men, look at your wives and children, look at the indignity of their lives and the difficulty of their lives. All you have to do is get together with your fellow workers and refuse to do what you're told. When you refuse to do what you're told altogether, they can do nothing. They can't have any production if you don't do it, because you're the one who does it. So they went. You know, you have to talk to these boys like children sometimes. They just don't behave themselves. You've got to tell them off.
Did you intentionally assume the posture or the persona of an older woman and act like a mother so that you could get them to do what they wanted to do?
I was a mother, and they knew it. They knew that I loved them like a mother, that I would stand for no monkey business among them, and that I expected them to be strong. I expected them to be honest. I expected them to be brothers, and that was what they responded to. They knew I was their mother. They knew I loved them more than they were my boys. I always called them my boys, and I always will.
How about the women and the children?
The women. You know, there's nothing braver than a woman from a mining camp. Do you know the kind of conditions that they had to put up with? I tell you, no water, no plumbing, no anything. And cold, these shacks that the company put up for them to live in, and then charged them terrible, terrible rents, high, high rents. And then they had to buy all their stuff from the company store at prices that were greatly inflated. These women managed on next to nothing to keep their families alive. And they smiled and sang songs. And I mean, these are wonderful, brave women. I love these women. I took care of them when they were sick. I took care of their children. They are my children too, you know. They're all my children.
What brought you to the communities of the textile workers and the miners? Was this your home?
I lived in Chicago. That's where I lived. I came from Canada, but I lived in Chicago. But I went. I was on the payroll of the United Mine Workers Union, you know. Yes, around the turn of the century, I was on their payroll. And we, union organizers, we would go wherever we were needed. If things were quiet in the mine fields, well, I'd go to the steel workers if they were having a strike. And they would call, they'd send for me. I had a telegram once from, Mother, come at once, we're having a strike in the silk mills. You are needed here. And so I went.
And when you were there, what did you do? Did you have to enter the area clandestinely? Were you that dangerous?
Yes, well, when I was in the mine areas and the railroad yards, I'd get by, you know, these guards, they'd hire these guards. They were called detectives, but in fact, they were just gun thugs. And they would call them mine guards. And they hired them from a detective agency, you know, the Baldwin Feltz agency. Oh, they were awful people, thugs, all of them. Anyway, to get around them, they would think that I would pretend that I was a little widow woman, which I was, a little widow woman giving out religious pamphlets. And they would let me through. Of course, after they got to know me, that was another story. But it took a while, you know. I got into all kinds of places, down into the mines themselves. Yeah, I had friends in low places.
Tell us the life of the mine, the miner in the mine, deep down in the earth.
Ah, when I first came into the mines, that was an amazing kind of work. These men would stand, when they were standing, in water that dripped from the sulfur water, that dripped from the ceiling, onto the floor, and they'd stand in inches of sulfur water. Their feet were covered in sores. Their shoes, of course, didn't last at all. And sometimes when they were drilling for coal, they'd have to lie in the seam, you know, on their backs and be tapping overhead. They didn't have room to stand up in. Their lungs were filled with coal dust all the time. They died constantly from black lung disease. It was a very, very big, it is a very big problem. And the little boys, you can't believe how these little boys were kept down, and the trapper boys, you know, they'd sit in the mine all day long, opening and shutting the doors for the mules to go through, because mules used to drag these buckets of coal, these huge carloads of coal. And these little boys sit in the dark all day long, and then just open the door and close the door for the mules, and that's it. And imagine a child's life being spent like that. And then the breaker boys, you know, they'd sit up on the breaker. That's where they sort the rock, you know, from rock to coal. And they'd sit up there, and with their bleeding fingers hunched over, the coal chute would come down a chute, and they'd separate the coal from the rock. And that's what they did all day long. And the poor little things, you know, they thought they were men. You know how boys are. They get together and they think that they're big and strong and they're like men. But they didn't get any education. They didn't go to school. They're raising generations of very poor citizens, you know.
I'd like to take a moment and say that my guest this week is Mary Harris Jones, known to many as Mother Jones. Mother Jones will be presenting a performance of her life through the character and the persona of Ronnie Gilbert at Mendocino College on Sunday, March 16th at 7:30 in the evening. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Mother Jones, how come more people did not do what you did and be an agitator, try and change the social conditions?
Well, actually, there were people who did. Many people did. In fact, there were other women who did this work. You know, some people have a talent for certain things. I had a talent for speaking. I know it doesn't sound like it now, but in fact, I did. You know, there were many organizers. The problem for most of them was that they were met with terrible violence. And, for instance, I was sent into the Fairmount Field in West Virginia because to organize, and I agreed to go because because the male organizers had been so badly beaten that they were afraid to go back. I didn't blame them. But I told them, you know, I said, I'm not afraid of the sword or the scaffold, and I will go there. And I did go there. And I kept, my friends were all the working people of the area, and they kept me safe. They kept me from the guards, couldn't find me. They hid me out and so forth. You know, there were many organizers. That was a time of great organization. But as I say, I was devoted to it. Perhaps because I started late in life, you know.
Tell us what year you refer to, or the years when you say the time of great organization.
In the late 1800s, toward the end of the 19th century, was a time when, well, you see, circumstances cause it. The Industrial Revolution, what they call the Industrial Revolution, they should call it the Industrialists' Revolution, because they took over everything. Anyway, the capitalists saw a way of making more and more profits from the mines and from the factories, and they imported people from other countries to come in, people who were even worse off than our people were, and they worked for low wages, and they scabbed, which was what we call it. They were scabs. And you know, it took a while for me to understand that these people were not the enemy. I fought the scabs, but at the same time, I realized that they were going to be in the same situation as the other workers. They brought the wage scale down, and thousands of people were brought in for these enlarged industries and so forth. And it was a different time, you know. America used to be, when I was young, America was a rather an agrarian country. It wasn't so industrialized. And times had changed. And in the late 19th century, there was a system begun to be looked at. They were looking at the system and saying, what is wrong with this system? Basically, that we must always either be at war or be in a depression. And there must be so many people at the bottom of the pyramid holding up things for the people, the very few people at the top. And people began to look at that, you know?
Mother Jones, we're running out of our time here, and I wonder if you could just...
Oh, you never have enough time.
This is true. Life is short. As you learned before some of us. Could you answer quickly, before we must close, as to what is wrong with the system? You pose a very challenging question.
What is wrong with the system is that too few people have control of the resources. Too few people at the very top control what happens in the rest of the world. And most of the people on the bottom have got to learn to stick together. They can do it. That is the problem. We are all taught by the people who have control at the very top that we have no hope, and that is not true. We need to join our unions, come together, and we will fight. Get up off our knees, and we will see to it that life will be changed.
Mother Jones, I want to thank you very much for joining us here at Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you the question I ask all of my guests, and that is, could you please tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
Oh, an interesting book. Oh, my goodness. Why didn't you tell me about this? I've no idea. I don't have time to read. Oh, yes, I like Tolstoy very much.
Well, Mother Jones, thank you very much for joining us here at Radio Curious.
You're very welcome.
And Ronnie Gilbert, I'd like to welcome you to Radio Curious in the real person that you are.
Thank you. Sometimes I wonder.
How is that, switching from one character to another? I guess the second character, Ronnie Gilbert, is perhaps a bit easier for you?
I don't know. It just depends what time of the day.
How is it that you chose to create the one-act play about Mother Jones?
Well, I went to visit. I was on tour. I was doing a concert tour down in the West Virginia, Tennessee area, and I heard about a strike that was going on. This is about the beginning of the 90s, about a big coal strike. The Pittston Coal Company was on strike, and there was, and I had gotten word about it through various alternative newspapers, but there was nothing about it in the major papers at all. Though it was a worldwide phenomenon that people were watching from everywhere. So I thought, we had a couple of days off, and I thought, well, let's go and see what a contemporary, what a modern strike is like and who's involved in all of that. And we went to a place called Camp Solidarity, which was the reception center for this strike, where thousands of people would come at times to rally and to listen to speeches and to help out and whatever. And there I saw the most amazing thing. Here were the women of the mining towns, the wives and daughters, and some of the miners themselves. Women have been miners in this past several decades. And they were all wearing these red T-shirts. And the T-shirts said, "Daughter of Mother Jones." And I thought, my God, I had heard about Mother Jones. In fact, I'd read her autobiography when I was young. And I thought, this woman is still alive here. It's not just the magazine with her name on it. This woman's legend is still alive. And so it led me to go back, read the autobiography again, and then all the related materials that I now found about her. She is a most fascinating, very funny character, great sense of humor, and reading her speeches and her letters and so on, it just paints a picture of a most phenomenal kind of person. She should be on postage stamps. In fact, I think somebody is trying to get that to happen. And she should be, you would think that she would be a household word even today, because so much of what she worked for and about is going on this very time, you know. So that was my hope, was that I could tell people about her.
And then you drew the song Agitator and created that.
Yeah. I imagined what she would say of herself, or what other people would say of her, and it was very easy. You've been steeped in her speeches and her letters and so on, as I have for so many years.
Well, let's take a moment and listen to Ronnie Gilbert singing about Mother Jones.
In the holler where the sun never shines, she took her stand with the men in the mines, with the boy at the breaker, the girl in the mill. Well, she hollered so loud you can hear her still, and they called her Agitator. They said, Mother Jones, how'd she get so strong? Mother Jones, how'd she live so long? Well, Mother Jones, she never been to me. Mother Jones showed them how to be free. The system couldn't buy her for any sum. I wouldn't sit down to dinner with a capitalist, she said. The workers adored her, they called her mother. The bosses called her the most dangerous woman in America. Some called her wobbly, some called her red. Some said they loved to see her dead. She wasn't scared of their guns, she never shed any tears. And she lived to be near 100 years as a goddamn agitator. They said, Mother Jones, how'd she get so strong? Mother Jones, how'd she live? Your shirt, well, it's the stick in the middle that does the work. It talks and it twists, and it may be mean, but it'll
can we look forward to in your one-person stage play of Mother Jones?
Lots of songs. That's just one song out of maybe six or more songs that fit into various parts of her life and what she was doing, what was going on, and so forth. Jeff Langley, who is, I think people in Ukiah probably know Jeff Langley, wrote the music to these songs, and I wrote the lyrics. And so they'll get that, and then they'll get Mother Jones and me.
Well, Ronnie Gilbert, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious and bringing Mother Jones to us on this program. And before we close, I want to ask you the same question I asked Mother Jones, and that is, could you tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yes, I'll tell you about an interesting book. You won't believe this. The book is Hawaii. You know the book Hawaii?
Yes, the Michener book.
Because recently I got a chance to have a vacation, a non-work-related vacation, and I wanted to find out about Hawaii. And some of the information in that book about labor is just exactly where Mother Jones would have been if she'd gotten to Hawaii.
And that's Hawaii by James Michener.
Michener, yeah.
Well, Ronnie Gilbert, thanks very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mother Jones, born in 1830 as Mary Harris Jones, was an active union organizer for more than 50 years. She's portrayed in this interview by actress, singer, and songwriter Ronnie Gilbert. The books that Mother Jones recommends, even though she said she doesn't have time to read, are the works of Leon Tolstoy. The book that Ronnie Gilbert recommends is Hawaii by James Michener. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.